Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming today to hear Marta Werner. I've been wanting Marta to come here for a long time, preferably permanently, but at least for a day it would be lovely. And I've known about her work for many years and been friends with her for the last few years, and just really excited that she can be with us. And if I had a mind for scholarly work myself, I would want to do work as interesting and elegant as Marta's, so I think you're in for a treat today. And now I turn things over to Beth Staley, who will do our main introduction. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Marta Werner is a professor of English at DeYouville College. In her faculty profile, she says, "I think I was not truly happy until I learned to read." But let me explain what reading is for Marta in five stages, from transcription to empathy. Because when she encounters a rare fragment, collage, or notebook in a writer's archive, her devotion to reading it is an activating, multisensory process. First, yes, to read is to transcribe, and to transcribe is to commit. When she finds three handwritten fragments by Emily Dickinson pinned together like a bird in Amherst College Library, Marta deciphers not only the words themselves, but also the dated scripts, paper surfaces, leaf alignment, plus every mark, incision, tear, and pinprick. Second, to read is to listen, and to listen is to follow. If a line in one of Dickinson's fragments echoes one from her poems or letters, Marta notes it. If a handful of texts are written on seals, wrappers, or the backs of telegraphs, she says so. Across these groupings, Dickinson's voice emerges anew. This is different from turning pages in a book. A truly devious and enlightening reading, Marta says in Radical Scatters, her digital archive of Dickinson's fragments, must therefore attend to the mystery of the encounter between poems, letters, and fragments, listening especially to the ways in which the fragments, like leitmotifs, the turns and returns of a melody, both change the modalities of the compositions in which they momentarily take asylum and carry these leitmotifs beyond the finished compositions into a freer, often more amplified space. And that's Marta's quote. Third, to read is to bear witness, which is to bear the burden of what can and cannot be known. Marta's scholarship measures the known and unknown by asking, what was Dickinson writing? For whom? When? Where? At her desk or at her pantry? Why the scraps of wrapping paper and envelopes, the quivering lettering? How do a text's condition and fate alter their utterance? This is an exercise in historical contextualization and bibliographic inquiry. As they eclipse one another, one comes back to the manuscript itself. Fourth, to read is to hold, and to hold anything is to weigh presence and absence, the artifact and its mystery, the poetic image and its psychic weight. This is the touch point. Marta returns without romanticization to the moment when the bird-like manuscript of fragments was in her palm. Reading isn't started by this moment, it's startled by it. This moment is powerful without being empowering. Approaching the fragment with literary scholarship creates what Marta calls a contradictory situation. She explains that either the discourse about the fragment must deny it as what it is and falsely make it into a whole, or it must itself be put into question in its claim to master the text. So finally, to read is to keep reading, which is to empathize with the writer who you've come to know but will never know via the text that can be held by but not beholden to you. One of my favorite Dickinson fragments comes to mind, found via Marta's archive. On document A879, it reads, "We must travel abreast with nature if we are to know her. But where shall be obtained the horse? A something overtakes the mind. We do not hear it coming." The question of the horse is one of access to those places and texts that will overtake our minds and profoundly impact us. I'm grateful to Marta for providing the horse, for sharing access to rare works by Dickinson, Nathaniel and Sophia Hawthorne, and Hannah Weiner, editorial feats which have earned her the Bowers Prize and Joad Boitzid Prize for textual scholarship. To echo her quote about learning to read, I can honestly say that I don't think I was truly happy until I learned to read like Marta. From transcription to empathy, her work will inspire how you perceive literature, yourself, your field, your objects of study, and your manner of communicating within and about them. Please enjoy her lecture.
Thank you so much, Marianne, for inviting me, and Beth for what is such a beautiful introduction. I think I don't need to give a paper. So, kind of, you can all go home now. She said it all. But thank you very, very much for being here on a beautiful day at 11 o'clock in the morning. And what I have for you today is kind of a combination of older work and newer work, but all of it kind of in line with a thinking about late work, which I've been doing for some time with Dickinson, but also more generally about what makes a late work late. And my thinking, although it may not be completely obvious from this particular talk, is influenced by very much by Adorno, but also by Benjamin, and a kind of thinking about lateness as a kind of disjunction, but also a new kind of connection. So I hope some of that may come through in this, and I hope that the disjunctions in this talk, which tries to bridge older and newer work, will be not too obvious, but we'll see. And I'm hoping that we can see the images, because really, if nothing else, right, the talk is lovely for its images. But there's a little over-projection, apparently. So I think this is the worst one, and hopefully you'll be able to see them a little bit better. But if there's things that you do want to see, we're a relatively small group, and they look beautiful on the screen. So we can do it that way. All right, so these tested our horizon, and that is, of course, a quote from Dickinson, scanning the distances in Dickinson's late manuscripts. Two passageways, two invitations open within Dickinson's late work. The first extends from Dickinson to a sometimes named, sometimes anonymous outside reader. The second stretches from a questioning alterity back to the writer, who in trying to meet it bypasses the reader and the established codes of communication and returns to a luminous yet illegible form of private notation. The letters and poem messages of the 1870s and 1880s, although already marked by a fanning out of specific address that has often been mistaken for clairvoyance, are still legible. They may be intercepted, even answered, by a vanishing reader. The fragments, on the other hand, a mob of traces, some in verse, others in prose, if we prefer a distinction that is by this time in extremis, belong to the prescriptive processes of thought, or rather, since these are retrieveless, to that moment when the words that lie in wait for thoughts suddenly ambush them, tracing a path for them in writing that briefly keeps pace with thinking, perhaps even outstrips it. Together and separately, they inaugurate a lyric non-discourse, scattered in an infinity of singular articulations and manifested finally as an absence d'oeuvre, untitled, unauthorized, and extra-generic. These whispers at the outer limits of Dickinson's work ask, where do I exit and go, and how do I proceed? A reader enters the scene of composition long after the author's departure. Dickinson's writing table, a small mahogany desk 18 inches square with a single drawer just deep enough for inkpots and stationery, stands cleared of unruly remains, exercised of ambiguities. It appears before us like a blank page. Yet Dickinson's manuscripts, the material witnesses of her late aesthetic itinerary, offer striking testimony about the spectacular turbulence and commotion, the pandemonium that attended the act of composition. In some cases, it appears that a fragment of text was composed on an already torn scrap of paper, drawn up or beyond its original use at the moment of inspiration. In other cases, Dickinson seems to have begun by composing a block of lines on a sheet of paper and then cut or torn most of the sheet away. Later, several random lines, saved for years, might be pinned together, reassociated along the lines of rhyme or theme. Millicent Todd Bingham, whose privilege was never to see Dickinson while she was alive, left this beautiful, accurate description of her late textual body. When first discovered, the manuscript looked impossible, a jumble of words on odds and ends of paper, some of it crumpled or torn, their pink scraps, blue and yellow scraps, all written in pencil and all in the late handwriting. The strokes are sometimes faint, and the lines often overlap, so that the words overtake one another as if written in the dark. Indeed, some thoughts are potent enough to have roused her from sleep. Today, the manuscripts of more than 100 of the fragments are stored in the vault of the Amherst College Library, the silent interior of an interior, a complex of protected spaces. The archive would have fascinated Dickinson, founded on the twinned ideas of memory and order. On the one hand, the archive offers, on the other, a shifting collection of pieces out of place, the remains of a heterogeneous estate that resist reintegration into any single perfect order. In the archive, even the most fragile, secret, or disconcerting elements of a writer's activity are carefully preserved. Here, where the present is suspended, the reader is projected into another time, another place. The questions that draw me into the archive also withdraw me into the rifts between history and memory, authorial intention, and textual revelation. I open a box filled with fragments and lost events. Inside folders pressed between leaves, I find perfect quatrains beside barely legible lists of words held together with straight pins. I am under the spell of traces, strange comminglings. With two clearly identified exceptions, the fragments that have survived amid so many hazards and losses were composed in the 1870s and 1880s. According to David Higgins, however, repeated phrases and sentences and compositions written in the mid-1850s suggest that an earlier collection of fragments, no longer extant, once existed. If this hypothesis is correct, then two groups of fragments, composed 20 years apart, mark the boundaries of Dickinson's high poetic style, as well as the boundaries of the 40 manuscript volumes, the first of which appears quite suddenly around 1858, and the last of which was completed less than 10 years later, in 1866, when Dickinson closed the doors of her private bindery forever. Although Dickinson's practice in the late 1850s and early 1860s of transcribing and binding copies or drafts of her poems into manuscript volumes, at which time she presumably jettisoned rough drafts, makes it impossible to establish a definitive chronology of composition, it is nonetheless clear that during these years, the onrush of vision was almost alarming. In the Annus Mirabilis of 1863, Dickinson composed, or at least copied, no less than 366 poems into manuscript volumes, almost one quarter of her oeuvre. Her creative energies, wrote Thomas Johnson, her editor of the 1950s, were at flood, and she was being overwhelmed by forces which she could not control. After 1870, the crisis over, Dickinson appears to enter a prolonged period of diminished or blocked productivity. In what would be the final phase of her work, she continues to draft poems, but she no longer copies them onto uniform sheets of paper or binds them into manuscript volumes, and the great majority remain in the worksheet stage. Fragments now also proliferate. So far, these fragments have been read as signs of failure, or at the very least, the intermittency of Dickinson's late vision. Yet if the stockpiling of a lost group of fragments in the mid-1850s was preparatory to Dickinson's first major aesthetic and stylistic shift, her break into poetry and bookmaking, is it not also possible that the accumulation of a significant body of fragments in the 1870s and 1880s announces the onset of a further stylistic crisis that has long gone unrecognized because its extremity has been alternately explained and overtaken by the biographical crisis of Dickinson's death in 1886? Rather than signifying the inevitable decline of creative energies, the late extant collection of fragments may mark the moment when, having simultaneously reached the outermost boundaries of the prevailing style of the 1860s and the limits of the Codex book, Dickinson was once again entering a transitional term of profound experimentation and instability. Outside the order of the manuscript volumes and beyond the locus of power, ambition was redirected, and writing, now literally a writing beyond the ending, governed by a new eros of inquiry. Marked by their remarkable and unprecedented exploration of the dialectics of exile and joy, dispossession and delight, The fragments are en route to a place they will never arrive. Linked to what is in transit, disappearing, they resemble fingerprints, the light touches of the artist, who, having submitted fully to the process of writing and constantly reaching new decisions, no longer thinks of finishing or holding on to any particular text. How can we retrace where they came from and in what direction they are traveling? If the metaphysician in search of the distant eschaton relies on his powers of farsightedness, the textual scholar favors nearsightedness, covets closer, more intimate discoveries. Sifting through the masses of papers, studying fragments day after day, the details of paper and pencil seem to dilate before my eyes until the unreflective surface of the library desk becomes a mysterious light table. Even in the context of Dickinson's own work, the fragments may at first seem sui generis, and their irregularity continues to be reflected in their bibliographical status as textual fugitives and as luxuries in the field of knowledge, fascinating and yet dispensable. Mistakenly called aphorisms and epigrams, as if Dickinson's style had become terse, lapidary, and bounded, instead of simply sudden, exorbitant in its artlessness and its claims to freedom. What these writings are remains undecidable. They may be passwords to unknown and still unwritten poems, codas to a lost vision, or singular transcriptions of the way Dickinson heard poetically. Composed in neither the past nor the future tense, but in what might be called the process tense, many of them reveal the kinesthetics of writing as dictation, the inscription of energy in which the hand that has begun to move across the page is seized and directed by an unknown agency, an other who, as Dickens wrote, comes and overtakes the mind. Fragments like glossolalia cross over the boundary lines of ordinary language, abolishing all bonds with the methods and measures of discourse. They write themselves. But ought not the amanuensis also to receive a commission? Of the more than 100 extant fragments, approximately half descend to us as exilic passages. In the more fully developed of these passages, Dickinson may be seen ranging freely about in the open spaces between or outside stanzas, where writing becomes a form of radical essaying, a way of rigorously avoiding the limits of the mind. Here, her exploration of the scattered centers of thought is graphically translated onto the paper's surface in the form of scribblings in the margins, cancellations, blocks of text divided or connected with dashes, ellipses suggesting the momentary eclipse of inspiration or only language. Here, at last, the extreme contraction characteristic of the earlier style periods is unworked in a language of pure hypothesis, in fragments upon which we have no purchase. Their subject appears to be some kind of transition, the approach of death, the break of day, whose accomplishment cannot be effected by reasoners making their careful way from proof to proof, but is instead endlessly postponed in order to render permanent the experience of the threshold. This Dickinson, a post-poetical Dickinson, whose late acute investigations are pensées on the order of Pascal and Wittgenstein, passes by, still unmet, a century after her death, on a crumpled pharmacy wrapper. A similar mirage of thought, bottle, slip, nothing is so resonant with mystery as the friend one that forgets us, and the wonder, boundlessness of him, her, so far it transcends heaven and hell that it makes them tepid and ignoble trifles. Again, on wrapping paper, spirit cannot be moved by flesh. It must be moved by spirit. It is strange that the most intangible is the heaviest, but joy and gravitation have their own ways. My ways are not your ways. Is always, we are always in danger of magic. The perils of magic cannot be overestimated. A single one thrill can end a life or open it anew forever. And this mystic territory, then, is life. On a fragment of white paper, death, being the first form of life, which we have had the power to contemplate, our entrance here being before our own comprehension, preliminary to our own and exclusion from comprehension, it is strange, amazing, that the fascination of our predicament does not entice us more. With such sentences as these directly over our heads, we are as exempt from exultation as the stones. And on the back of a bag, we must travel abreast with nature if we want to know her. But where shall be obtained the horse? A something overtakes the mind. We do not hear it coming. More common still than the investigative passages cited here are those fragments that descend to us like solitary outriders haunted by communion, shimmering and brief, eviscerated, as Emerson said, of care. Vulnerability is the mark of their existence. If they are the nuclei of poems or messages in a state of pure potentiality and in search of conditions yet to be defined, they are also often bolder than Dickinson's more finished texts. Like souls neither touching nor mingling, never composing a set, these positionless fragments depict the beauties of transition and isolation at once. Belonging to a chronology of the instant, an edition of them would have to present them as a discontinuous series, a book from which each page could be taken out. Here are several that arrive unaccompanied. Pompeii, all its occupations crystallized, everybody gone away. Incredible the lodging, but limited the guest. Lonesome as occupations, entertainments of ended minds. Flowers are so enticing, I feel they are sins, like gambling or apostasy. And then my favorite, the fatherless serpent. Sometime in 1884, Dickinson wrote on a small slip of paper the words, "most arrows," and attached the slip to an unfinished draft of a message poem sent to Susan Dickinson and composed on the anniversary of her youngest child's death. Twice, when I had red flowers out, Gilbert knocked, raised his sweet hat, and asked if he might smell them. "Yes, and pick them too," I said. But chivalry forbade him. Tudor was not a beggar. Most arrows slay but whom they strike. The slip then repeated the first two words of the message's closing lines. Most arrows slay but whom they strike. Sometime later, for reasons unknown, the slip was unpinned. Like this arrow text that both pierces and emanates from the heart of a heartbreaking message, many of the apparently autonomous fragments may have at one time been linked to other still unidentified texts. And in some instances, it is the arrows, rather than the text to which they were at one time linked, that have alone returned to us, sharp reminders that even a complete inventory of Dickinson's extant writings can never reveal how many more have been lost. Today, five lines, two on a scrap of Weston's linen, and three on a tiny fragment of quadrille stationery, fleetingly rumor the existence of two poems, almost certainly written by Dickinson in the 1870s, but now surviving only in transcripts made by Mabel Loomis Todd. Here is the first transcript. "Drowning is not so pitiful as the attempt to rise. Three times 'tis said a sinking man comes up to see the skies, and then declines forever to that abhorred abode where hope and he part company, for he is grasped of God. The Maker's cordial visage, however good to see, is shunned, we must admit it, like an adversity." Like the combination of dots and dashes used in Morse code to convey messages in abbreviated form, a single witness taps against the walls of Todd's transcription, revealing perhaps the somatic charge of the lost original. Grasped of God. And here is yet another in which, once again, the fragment is all that remains of a lost original. It's a transcript again. "No man saw awe, nor to his house admitted he a man, though by his awful residence has human nature been. Not deeming of his dread abode, till laboring to flee, a grasp on comprehension laid, detained vitality. Returning is a different route. The spirit could not show, for breathing is the only work to be enacted now. I'm not consumed, old Moses wrote, yet see him face to face. That very physiognomy, I am convinced, was this. And what remains in Dickinson's hand? Has human nature gone, unknowing of his dread abode? Finally, within the constellation of Dickinson's late writings are those fragments that are the augurers of more complete extant texts. Again and again, as if poems and letters and fragments communicated with one another telepathically, a line or phrase from a fragment may reappear, often in a slightly altered form, in the body of a poem, a message, or even another fragment. In 1955, when Millicent Todd Bingham first printed a selection of Dickinson's fragments in the New England Quarterly, she cautioned, "To trace the course of an idea from seed to flower, whether blossoming in a poem or a letter to a friend, would be a devious but enlightening study, a challenge to ingenuity and patience. Yet the painstaking and ongoing effort to identify all such trace fragments and link them with the messages and poems in which they appear will not affect any lasting closure. For neither residents nor aliens, neither lost nor found, these fragments are caught between their attraction to a specific bounded text and their desire to continue the search for an open absolute text that can never achieve existence. A truly devious and enlightening reading must therefore attend to the encounter between poems, letters, and fragments, listening to the ways in which the fragments, the turns and returns of a melody, both change the modalities of the compositions in which they momentarily take asylum and carry them beyond the finished compositions into a freer space. Consider the following poem. Inside this poem, a fragment is secreted, sealed into it like a light. Even without knowing in advance that it is there, close reading quite often uncovers it. For the fragment is the flashpoint of the text beginning, a quickening word that comes unbidden and that turns our thinking inside out. Among Dickinson's remains on a scrap of brown wrapping paper, we find this excruciating offering, a woe of ecstasy. In this instance, the fragment exists in two textual spaces at once, in the poem message as a variant or rhyming trace of its final lines, and as an autonomous lyric throw, not jettisoned once the poem is finished, but translated into another economy altogether. To be sure, something is negotiated between the fragment and the poem held spellbound together for an instant, not least of all the poem's boundaries. But unlike the lists of variants that stream after so many of Dickinson's poems of the 1860s, this fragment is neither visually nor syntactically subordinated to the poem proper. On the contrary, a woe of ecstasy rhymes with its variant and re-enters the drive of writing, a presence after presentness. Only the barest signs of a struggle remain. Three dashes rend the text at the points where the fragment migrates into the poem and then disengages from it again, while along the top edge, a light horizontal line, like the lines Dickinson sometimes drew to separate the body of a poem from its variants and later to divide tiny increments of thought, is a graphic sign that these lines were once the last lines of a poem since torn away. Now the end, the variant, has become a new beginning. Outside the labor of the poem's argument, alone again, the fragment seeks the exact conditions for poetry and becomes pure potential. Moreover, by reversing the conditions of inwardness, it extends exponentially the original impetus of both poem and work toward non-closure. A trope or turn, a woe of ecstasy, does not so much orient the poem in which it appears as a citation as illuminate the inner contradictoriness, the paradoxes, the antinomies, out of which Dickinson's poetry, all poetry, is engendered. Again and again, fragments and their traces, like opposing poles, pull away from each other. Here again, a few lines jotted down on a fragment of an envelope seal, or fame erect her sightless citadel, drift out of the poem, beginning step lightly on this narrow spot. that originally contained them to seek a new end. And similarly, the poem The Last of Summer is Delight, composed around 1876, will come undone years later, as evidenced by the fragments that flowed out of it, carrying it in different directions. The Last of Summer is a time for chastened retrospect, 'tis ecstasies divine, sublime, revealed review, enchantments postulate, testament, syndicate, to meet it nameless as it is without celestial mail. The last close of summer is result, delight, survey, subdued to retrospect, revised to retrospect. The poem, constituted out of such fragments, arrow texts aimed in different directions, is revealed as an excerpt, a citation from a text without beginning or end, a thought subject to be thought again and again. Thus, in 1877, after finishing the poem, after all birds have been investigated and laid aside, Dickinson suddenly began to unwork it, to write it apart. First, she jotted down a variant for the second stanza. First, at the march, competing with the wind, her joyful cry, cordial note, exalts us like a friend, last to adhere when summers swerve away, fortitude stanched with melody. Later, the line or the thought contracted still further. Her gallant note endows us like a friend when summer cleaves away. And similarly, in 1874, approximately 10 years after making a fair copy of A Drop Fell on the Apple Tree, and 3 years after completing a fair copy of Remember Me, Implored the Thief, Dickinson suddenly scribbled down two fragments, both from these poems, on the back of an envelope. Myself computed, were they pearls, what legacy could be. And O magnanimity, my visitor in paradise. Why did she suddenly remember differently a few lines from two poems written years apart and dash them down together? At what instant did two increments of thought, never before linked, suddenly appear on the same empty horizon, drawing two fragments and thus also two poems into relation? And why, after a decade, were the poems turned back into fragments, arrow texts, shot, as Blake writes, into the airy way? Although the random and ephemeral thoughts Dickinson scribbled down on pieces of paper during the final decade of her life have long since turned into printed words, these late fragments remain undomesticatable. They cannot simply be contained in appendices, or as in the case of the trace fragments, annexed to the more familiar world of the finished compositions in which they are held spellbound for a moment. The fragments, like quotations of other voices, continually set these texts adrift in more unpredictable directions. And so, in the second part of this talk, I'd like to follow a series of texts set adrift in an especially resonant way, Dickinson's late writings on envelopes. Long, long ago, during a visit to the Amherst College archives, I discovered an astonishing manuscript when it fell or flew out of an acid-free envelope and out of the space of claustration. Although its brevity and immediacy place it beyond the reach of conventional classifactory gestures, it bears a striking affinity to the genre David Porter called small, rickety infinitudes. Untitled, we know it simply by its catalog number, A-A21-A. A-A21 is a sudden collage made up of two sections of envelope. The principles of its construction are austere, economical. The larger section of the collage is the inside of the back of an envelope, the address face of which has been torn or cut away. One vertical crease bisects the document, turning the halved envelope into a primitive diptych that resembles the hinged wings of the bird the manuscript is becoming. Initially, the leaves' wings appear to have been folded, perhaps even pinned closed. At rest, the manuscript has not yet been transformed into a fully living figure. Another section of text is composed on an unfolded triangular corner of the envelope seal. It has been designated by the cataloger A-821A. a single straight pin in place when I first saw the manuscript, but later removed for preservation purposes, originally imped the collage elements together while also spreading open the larger envelope fragment to reveal a blurred message about an imminent transition or about the desire of writing to intervene between the visible and the invisible. The unfolding of the manuscript creates a strange visual rhyming of wings, themselves signifiers for immateriality, for bodies that are not subject to the laws of gravity and which can communicate between time and eternity. By composing A21 on the reverse of an empty, unaddressed envelope, no longer the container for a message, but the message itself, Dickinson creates a template for flight that is also a trope for her late contrapuntal communications, in which arrival is only another name for departure. In other places, I try to follow this text, its initial point of departure, its many changes, of course. Today, though, I set it only briefly before us, preferring in this moment to explore the larger constellation of documents associated with it, the approximately 50 works Dickinson composed on envelopes. The nature of Dickinson's connections to these writings remains enigmatic, for while it is unlikely that she set out to record a series of poems, messages, and fragments on envelopes, once we have seen the documents, it becomes difficult to dissociate the texts from their carriers. Flocked together for a few moments before dispersing again into other equally provisional constellations, they remind us that a writer's archive is not amassed only out of a set of easily inventoried contents, poems, letters, but also a storehouse of ephemeral remains, bibliographical escapes. Like so many of Dickinson's writings, the envelope texts discovered in an initial sweep of the major collections of her manuscripts often vex genre boundaries. Most, however, appear to be rough copy poems or the lyric beginnings or endings of poems. The earliest envelope poem may have been composed around 1864, the date Ralph Franklin assigns to the last of Dickinson's bound fascicles. And a handful of other envelope texts, four by Thomas Johnson's dating, two by Franklin's, belong to the same decade. The remaining envelope poems bear composition dates ranging from 1870 to 1885, evidence, perhaps, that Dickinson's practice of composing on envelopes intensified in the wake of fascicle production and at the juncture when she was testing differently and for a final time the relationship between message and medium. Composed, too, at the end of a century whose dream of communication as the mutual communion of souls was often realized or shattered in the fate of written messages, Dickinson's envelope poems seem charged with a special poignancy and hermeneutical burden. Unlike the original communications they may once have enclosed, the envelope poems discovered among Dickinson's papers after her death are addressed to no one and everyone at once. Scattered by the winds of the future, intercepted by unknown and invisible readers permanently estranged from the writer, they remind us of the contingency, transience, vulnerability, and hope embodied in all our messages. Reportless subjects to the quick, continual addressed. Dickinson lived and wrote at the very historical moment when the possibility of delivering a private message to a specific addressee through the modern postal system was first fulfilled. By the late 1850s, writes media historian John Durham Peters, it was possible to mail a letter sealed in an envelope, paid for with a pre-purchase stamp, and dropped into a public box. And in her recent moving work on Dickinson, Virginia Jackson considers the many possible forms and figures of address. The way in which I address you depends upon where you are. If you are very near, I can whisper. If you are across the table, I can speak. If you are upstairs or just outside, I can shout. If you are too distant to hear, even to overhear my voice, I can write. And in the illusion peculiar to written address, the condition of your absence, the condition of my writing, conjures a presence more intimate than a whisper. Before bearing poems, the envelopes found among Dickinson's papers presumably carried such cloistered dispatches. Of these, some that she later turned back into drafting spaces were originally addressed to her or members of her family by persons beyond the walls of the homestead. the hands of her Norcross cousins, Josiah and Elizabeth Holland, Abigail Cooper, Judge Otis Lord, and Helen Hunt Jackson, among others, crossed them in ink, affixed the requisite number of stamps, and committed them to the Postal Service. The remaining envelopes are addressed by Dickinson to cherished outsiders. Unlike the envelopes mailed to her by others, these almost always bear only a name and, on rare occasions, an abbreviated address. Like Dickinson's untitled and undated poems, which circulated outside the conditions of print and the economy of technical reproducibility, the original messages these envelopes presumably enclosed eluded the postal system's public circuits of exchange and were conveyed, if at all, by more intimate and now anonymous carriers. Neither stamped nor postmarked, their histories of transmission and reception are impossible to trace. Returning is a different route, Dickinson wrote around 1874. If the envelopes addressed by Dickinson to others relayed communications received but long since discarded from their covers, lost or destroyed according to customer chance, why and by what path or agent did the empty casings come back to her? If, as may also be possible, these envelopes never left her possession, why did she address them at all? Were they only the potential carriers for letters Dickinson wrote or intended to write, but ultimately withdrew? Could the poems inscribed on envelopes, both those unsent or returned to her and those sent to her by others, be the true messages she wished to transmit, but never did? To whom were they directed, to the living or to the dead? There is a striking contrast between the address Dickinson inscribed on the envelope's face in ink and the poem she composed on its back or inside. This contrast corresponds in part to a split intention in the writer. The addresses often appear in a magnified, fair copy script and mark Dickinson's wish to send an indelible message to a singular addressee still present and locatable in the world. The poems, on the other hand, scrawled in the small, dense, rough copy script Higginson described as resembling the fossil tracks of birds, mark her desire to compose a fleeting message to a stranger from another unknown world. How can we ever verify the degree of match between what is transmitted and what is received? The interval separating address and poem, whether minutes, hours, days, or years, is indeterminate and may become infinite. Thus, while it is tempting to see the poems composed on envelopes addressed to the same person as installments of an extended message to him or her, to see the addressee as the enciphered somehow in the poems, the fragmentary narratives that emerge from such an approach often remain frustratingly unconnected to identifiable circumstances in the lives of either sender or recipient. What is renounced in the turning of the envelope from face to back is the letters, the poems, potential to conjure the addressee's presence through words. Even when I hold your letter in my hands, I am not touching you. What is affirmed in this very same turn is the mysterious distance separating sender and receiver, but through which they nonetheless continue to signal each other. A message enclosed in an envelope, a poem inscribed upon it and prepared for sending over miles or millennia, is not a bit or byte of information, but an archive of longings. No wonder, then, that we find among Dickinson's envelope poems several enacting the ecstatic reconciliation of souls. Long years apart can make no breach a second cannot fill. For example, attest to the powers of writing to overcome time and space, to collapse the distance dividing writer and addressee, who may then recognize each other instantaneously, despite a revolution in forms. The fantasy, however, recurs only rarely in Dickinson's work. Far more often, the envelope poems emphasize the address gap, depict the vast expanse sundering writer and reader, so often also lover and beloved. As if we needed reminding, Jerome Miller writes, "All the beings toward which wonder draws us are themselves drawn irretrievably toward nothingness." And so, in Through What Transports of Patience, comes the recognition that the addressee is unreachable, separated from the writer, who seeks him or her by a void or blank that, not measurable by human scales, can never be traversed in this world. Similarly, the brief but excruciating poem beginning "A Not Admitting of the Wound," in which we learn only that the source of the speaker's injury is her severance from the beloved, and that the wound is so wide that her entire existence has now entered it, bears witness to the anguish that attends our perception of what Emerson recognized as the infinite remoteness of our condition. In this case, the translation of the wound into words remains unaccompanied by an interpretive process that might treat the speaker by turning her literal hurt into a figurative one. The envelope is the repository of damages it cannot heal or even contain. Slit open, it functions not as a soothing bandage, but rather as a second simultaneous site of rupture. "What a hazard a letter is," Dickinson scrawled in a late fragment composed in a handwriting so disordered it seems to have been formed in the dark. "Just when we least suspect the arrow is aimed for us, we are letter-struck, and thus on the back of another envelope stored or abandoned among Dickinson's papers, its cover nearly translucent, its tendril-like address penned in a watery blue lavender, we find a summons to the end of the world. The luxurious slowness of the message's passage over the terrain of the 19th century by train or carriage cannot defer the suddenness with which we receive it. Death warrants are supposed to be, believed to be, an enginery of equity, a merciful, hazardous mistake, a pencil in an idol's hand, a devotee has oft consigned to crucifix or block, stake. Speed was Dickinson's watchword. She lived and wrote in the century of suddenness, amid the rise of new telecommunications technologies that transformed forever the forms of human contact. The new media, writes Peters, gave life to the older dream of angelic contact by claiming to burst the bonds of distance and death. So did they also deliver us into new solitudes. One of the uncanniest documents in the constellation of Dickinson's writings on envelopes is a Western Union telegraph blank addressed to Vinnie Dickinson, care of Judge Lord, and marked "paid by the sender." The urgent message it conveyed, copied by a nameless telegrapher with strict instructions to carefully read every letter, to repeat obscure sentences or difficult words, and to keep a daily record of all difficulties, interruptions, or incidents occurring in the working of the lines, has vanished. Yet in the poems that take its place, "Glass was the street in tinsel peril, and it came his turn to beg," Dickinson appears to be translating the electrical pulses of the original and unrecoverable bulletin into new messages associating swiftness with shock. The breakdown and cancellation of the final words and phrases of these dictations to Dickinson by someone or thing from the outside may be verification that perfect communion between minds, or even between the mind that thinks and the hand that writes, is not achievable. Transmissions in this world are asymmetrical and full of gaps. We receive them only ever in part. Springs shake the seals. Among Dickinson's envelope poems, we find an exquisite subset of lyric fragments written on the seals or flaps of these envelopes. Disconnected from their original bodies, the seals compose a coda for all of Dickinson's late writings received in pieces as fragments. The tiny scale and luminous properties of the seal link it to the world of the miniature, to the keepsake or amulet. In writing, the seal is the ideal container for the aphorism, a minimum sign invested with maximal energy. Only a few lines long, the poems inscribed over seals bear witness to the evanescence of existence, brief as a single day or as the isolate, piercing notes of a bird. Saved against all odds, unsealed for all the world to see, they carry Dickinson's last exorbitant message about fame's sightlessness and her final canceled caution against doubt. In this short life, the only merely lasts an hour, how much, how little is within our power. One note from one bird is better than a million words. A scabbard has, holds, needs but one sword. The vastest earthly day is shrunken, shriveled, dwindled, small by one defaulting face behind a pall, is chastened, small, by one heroic face that owned it all. There are those who are shallow intentionally and only profound by accident. Which has the wisest men undone? Doubt has the wisest. Society, for me, my misery, since gift of thee, or fame erect her sightless citadel. One of the 19th century words for envelope was cover. And metaphors of envelopes are metaphors often of containment, of exteriority and interiority, of enfolding and exposure. In Dickinson's case, though, the sovereign force of the envelope's addresses, with their promise of exclusivity, is ultimately countered by the poem's openness to a multiplicity of recipients, an array of futures. The barely audible whirring of the envelopes is part of the message they are sending, slit open, unfolded, written across, and handed over to chance. They reject the asylum offered by the lyric poem to probe the last privacies of our existence. In the last seconds just before departing, I want to take one final glimpse of A821 flying here on the screen and vying with light. In order to determine whether or not certain birds possess homing instincts, a person known as a liberator throws several up into the air and then turns and turns again, each time releasing more birds in different directions. The birds are then watched out of sight and the point at which they disappear from view recorded. When a significant number of vanishing points have been noted, a scatter diagram is drawn up for study. At times, for reasons poorly understood, large numbers of birds seem to lose their way back to the original release point and drift widely across the migration axis. Beyond the fascicles, beyond even Dickinson's writing desk and the room it occupies, the air is filling with her papers. Circling the absent center of the book, Dickinson's late unbound poem drafts and fragments resemble the distant migrants that do not come fully into focus and so never constitute a clearly delimitable constellation. The wind moves them, time moves them. If in a given moment one or two seem to be in close touch, each in the next moment seems remote from the others, unassimilatable to a larger figure whose moving edges drift and blur. In the end, however, these exceptions may reveal more than the rule about the state of Dickinson's art. Located at the outermost limits of her work, in the unfamiliar and largely unprobed region of the document, they illuminate the requirements of her aesthetics of radical inquiry and attest to the possibility of a thought no longer guaranteed by unity. Having abandoned the institution of authorship early on in her writing life, Dickinson was able to set in motion a work without beginning or ending. The drafts and fragments, the work in throes, scatter it in all directions at once. They test our horizons. Instead of classifying the envelope writings according to conventional bibliographical terms, we need to find ways of launching them into circulation again and again. Ideally, the reader of these writings will assume the role of liberator, releasing them high up into the ether, following them until they are out of sight, noting their vanishing points, and whenever possible, replying to them, counting each brief connection with them as an instant of grace. Thank you. In the 1955 Johnson Variorum, both you'd have to look at the poems, the 1955 poems and the 1958 letters.
But what you'll find there, which is sort of why you might not find them initially when you look, is that they look very, very different. And particularly what Johnson did at that point, and the letters haven't been re-edited since the 1950s, right? So that's a big problem in and of itself. But what he did was he took these things that she didn't know how to classify, and he put them in a section called prose fragments. And then he sort of decided where one ended and where one began. And so you'll often find the recto, the text that's on the recto of a manuscript, one place, and then far, far away from it, you find the text on the verso. So there are these sort of odd separations which make it difficult to, first of all, imagine the relations among them. But they are there, at least they, in some way. And in the when they were considered poems, they were published as part of the 1955 Variorum and then also the 1998 Franklin Variorum. And in that case, oftentimes what you'll find is that because they're so heavily revised, you'll find that many of the variants you'll see in the notes, sort of there's a kind of big text, right, and then there's the sort of text underneath it. And I understand why they do that. I understand how to make an edition. But I think it's a real problem with Dickinson's works because we don't know oftentimes what she would have considered the hierarchy, right, of what she was choosing. And even, I mean, this is obvious when you look at the sort of what we call finished poems, right? They're in a fair copy hand, and she's bound them, and yet at the same time you have all these variants. So yes, you can find them all. And then Jen Bourbon and I just did an edition of the envelope poem specifically in a couple of different versions. The one that's over there with New Directions, and we were so lucky. We worked with New Directions, but also the Christine Bergen Gallery, and they tried to, in this second edition, do what we had done in the first one, which is my favorite, which was the artist book. But and we were hoping. I mean, it was meant to be. It is my favorite, but it's $3,000. I myself couldn't afford to buy it, so I received a copy as my payment. But what we were trying to do in that was to give the things scale, you know, to scale, and then our diplomatic transcriptions. And then, if, you know, to show the verso, too. So to do recto and verso. And then also to suggest that the one thing I never liked about binding books, right, and I had this objection from my very first book, which was a collection of drafts, and I called it Open Folios, and then they told me, and the first thing I wanted to do was to put it in a box. But you can't really do that with a university press. They object to boxes. It's hard to sell. It's hard to market. So they didn't let me do it. And my only the concession they made was I didn't have to put page numbers on so that there was this sense of you know, not ordering things. And they did that, I think, really well in the New Directions version by not following the catalog numbers even, because usually what happens is there'll be a kind of, well, we don't know when these were exactly composed, we don't know the chronology, but we'll put them in the order that the cataloger put them, which is not a chronological order. But what they did, really by our instructions, was to try to arrange them visually so that there were kind of visual resonances among the documents rather than just numbering. But yeah, they're in various versions. And now, and I should really sort of mention this because it's such an important moment in Dickinson's studies. In the last few years, it started with Amherst College's initiative to kind of go completely open access to everything. And they put every single manuscript in their Dickinson collection online, free and open and downloadable to the public. And Harvard churlishly complied, realizing that if they didn't, it was over. The 200-year copyright, or whatever, some absurd number of years of copyright they had over Dickinson, the time was not, it was done. And so they decided that they would put their collection online too, a little more slowly. So you can't see any letters there, but you can see poems. I think they made a pretty serious. I'm on the editorial board, so I think it's fair to say that I think they made a serious error in how they did it. They didn't. What Amherst did is they just took everything in their collection and they put it online. What Harvard did, because I think that they were thinking about copyright issues still, is they took the 1998 Variorum as the base text, as their copy text, as opposed to making the manuscripts the copy text. And so they based what they put online on the contents of the Variorum. Now, as a textual editor, I would have major objections to that way of proceeding. The copy text is not Franklin's. I mean, I think Franklin's a fantastic editor, but the copy text is not his 1998 Variorum. Right? The copy text is very clearly her manuscripts. And when you move backward from an edition and then say, oh, and here's the illustration, that then you're making manuscripts illustrations as opposed to copy texts. And I think that, it might not be obvious if you're just looking. It's great. It's still a beautiful, beautiful resource. Right? You can find a lot of things you could never have found before. But it contains theoretical problems that will that will come to haunt readers who aren't very, very familiar with what they're looking for. Lots of things are sort of mixed up there. But they'll get it right eventually. Yeah.
I'm glad you went into that. I was really interested in what you had to say about the sort of form of distributing these things. But I guess I was wondering, and I love what you're doing, going back and forth between the sort of ethos of the collection and that of the fragments and wanting to keep on with them both. And I was just wondering if personally you, as you're working with these fragments, found there were any of them you really did not want to make part of the collection.
That's a great question.
You wanted to preserve it as its own thing, and why?
That's a very good question. And I think, it's funny. I can still find, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I can still find some of Dickinson's work embarrassing. Right? I mean, I think that as writers, writers' work is not even. And when you look at it, and particularly when you're looking at someone who left us everything, or at least what we have, but who didn't herself present it in a particular way, you're faced with a large question of what would she have wanted. I kind of put that aside as an editor or as somebody thinking about what are the uses of these things beyond their perhaps beauty, right? And what is the use of seeing, particularly because I'm interested in compositional process, that perhaps allows me to think of documents as beautiful or interesting even when they might not be, right? When I might not find them to be the aesthetic height of Dickinson's work. But yes, there were. And when I was initially working particularly on the first archive, the big archive of the fragments, I had a really hard time, and I still do, defining what that meant. Right? What qualifies as a fragment? And I think it's still a very open question. I'm uncomfortable with the term, but it reminds me of how uncomfortable I am with all of the genre terms that we give to Dickinson's works, because they're so uncertain. I mean, they're only kind of, it's only very early when she's writing sort of in the 1850s, let's say, the late 1850s, maybe early 1860s, where I can say for sure there's a major distinction between a poem and a letter. And then the distinctions start to blur so much. What I did, and it was really a matter of practicality, was I decided that when I decided if something was a fragment or not, I had to disqualify it as what I thought was clearly a draft of a message to someone, even if it didn't get there, right? But something that had a specific addressee in mind. And I took those to be something else. I really wanted to look at things that had this ambiguity of genre, and if I didn't think it was quite ambiguous enough, I left it out. But it reminds me, too, right, that all of these sorts of presentations of Dickinson's work, whatever Amherst puts their collection up, right, so now we're thinking about it as what an archive owns, right, or Harvard puts theirs up, what they own, the Boston Public Library. Dickinson's manuscripts are all over the place. I mean, those are the three major collections, but there's stuff at Brown, there's stuff everywhere. So it then becomes this, what is whole, right? What is the whole of Dickinson? And I don't know. And I think that really, in some ways she herself, right, or the work itself, is questioning that notion. But we also have no idea of how much has been lost. And Ralph Franklin is not known as a not conservative editor, right? He's an immensely conservative textual editor. But even Franklin thinks that there were probably in the number of 5,000 poem manuscripts. Right? We have about 2,500, right, manuscripts. But he believes that there were at least 5,000, probably more, just for poems. And the untold losses among letters, who knows? Correspondence was hard to gather. And so just thinking about a whole Dickinson, even if we had everything, even if we had every extant thing, we would still be looking at something that was a fragment, right, that had broken off, and that is not really reconstructible. So it's an endless problem, and it's one reason why I think I stopped. I've said additions, but really I don't work on additions, because I do feel like the word addition carries with it a kind of expectation, right, of this is, of what we can say about documents. And I always feel like what I'm doing is more something like exhibitions, because I don't have that, I don't feel that certainty. I know different people do, right? I mean, if you talk to people editing Dickinson, there would be very different ideas about their level of certainty. I feel very, very uncertain. And it may be, just sort of long acquaintance with manuscripts and seeing how, even by the time I'm looking at a manuscript, it's already terribly mediated. We don't have any sense of the early transmission history. There are stories. So people will say, Lavinia found these poems in a locked box. She found 2,500 manuscripts in a locked box? how big was that box? I really doubt it. And so, I think what we're dealing with early transmission stuff is legend, which has become kind of, she found them in a locked box. Well, where is the box? Right? Nobody has it. It must have been enormous, just enormous. And so even those kinds of how the manuscripts got to where they were, who saw them, what hands they passed through, who took them apart. I mean, even when we were looking at the envelopes, there were some very, very interesting folding patterns. And I would love to have been able to say, Dickinson folded it like this, because, if you unfold them, there's this peculiar way of, thinking about how to read a text. But I don't know if she did. I can't say. And so I feel it's not that I don't want to say as much as one can say, but I'm also aware of the limits of what can be said and how easy it is for things that, how easy it is to say something and then have it become kind of, a sort of piece of critical, what appears to be critical knowledge, when really it was just a story. And so I think it's actually, I think I would like to be upfront, but what I'm always doing is telling a story, which may be accurate and may not be. And I certainly don't feel, I don't feel it's the final word in any sense. I don't know if that even goes towards answering your question. There were things I left out. Yes.
On their own, that putting them in a collection would be doing them a disservice.
I do feel that way. But I also feel that this kind of, there's a tension in Dickinson's work between this autonomy, right, a kind of extraordinary autonomy that each of these documents has, and this also oftentimes a will toward intertextuality. So that I feel different ways at different moments. I mean, one thing I found, certainly with the envelope poems, was that, initially that the A821, I had not been looking at it in terms of envelope poems. I was looking at it first because I wanted to look at all of the pinned documents that Dickinson had put together. And so my first work on that manuscript really had nothing to do with, it had something to do with envelopes, but it really didn't. It was really this other category. And then I thought, Jen was interested in working on, something that would have a visual appeal. And we also felt that, just because this is a sort of age of communication, that it would be good. So I started to think about it in that way. But there were there were the pinned documents. For me, a really kind of interesting category of texts was canceled texts. Dickinson's cancellations are, to me, they're like a form of handwriting. Because when she canceled something, she always left it open. You could always read it, always. And unlike, when somebody canceled things for her, which people sometimes did, you can't read that. maybe it's funny now because we have all, they didn't know, right, that we would have these incredible technologies where you could see through things. But certainly, right, the intent to cancel was to rub out. And in her case, the cancellation is often to leave open. And so those texts to me are extraordinarily beautiful. And particularly, there's a document that I really, really love, and it is actually one of the fragments. But it's a square of paper, and it's obviously been cut out from something larger. But it has a fair copy, beautiful fair copy text on one side that was could have been part of a letter. And it's about the middle of that text, and the word eyes just appears. And she's drawn two cancel lines through it. And then she clearly turned the paper over, and she scrawls this rough, very rough copy draft on skepticism, on what skepticism is. And I look at that thing together, and I think here's this beautiful, open, canceled text, which is all about the gaze and all about looking at it, this very specular document. And then I turn it over, and I find this meditation on what skepticism is. And I think, well, these things are obviously, right, there's obviously a connection. And yet the beautiful text is the one that's canceled, and the rough, skeptical text, right, is the one that remains uncanceled. And so those kinds of peculiar relations between recto and verso always fascinate me, right? I think they're incredibly interesting. And yes, there are documents that I keep hoping will fall out of collections, right? That I think AA21 is an example for me, right, because it was such a very potent document. But there are many others. And for a while I was doing this project where I would choose various fragments and I would try to write what I could about them. And I got up to about 10. Well, there's 90 more to go. I'm not sure I'm going to make it. I might want to do something else. And not all of them were equally resonant. But in each case where I isolated a document, that document did seem, right, to take on a life of its own and to be not part of a collection I had imagined it in. And so, you know, the very idea of things coming out of those collections is as important to me as gathering them in collections.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I often find that when I'm teaching Dickinson or someone else whose writing is just really, undeniably beautiful, like, they're better. That I sound better, that I teach better, I feel more articulate. And I just wondered if working with Dickinson has influenced your own writing or your prose, because it's possible to listen to your writing and to like follow vowel sounds. Let's say. write beautiful vowels in the house.
I'll be like, I can use that.
So I just wondered what, you know.
I think it's undeniably true. But I guess what I would hope to get from Dickinson, and I don't think I'm ever there yet, but what I prize in her writing, maybe the most, is a certain American harshness. And I really feel that. I grew up on the British 19th century. And I grew up in England, and I grew up reading, you know, Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, and I love that stuff, and I love British poetry. But Dickinson she has broken so far from that tradition, and it is that breaking in her voice that I love so much. And it's funny because we were just talking about this morning when I was talking about how when I teach the first part of American literature, I don't get to teach the 17th century anymore because no one likes the Puritans. I really love them. And one of the things I love about them is their weirdness with language. And I remember learning, and I found this extraordinary, I think it was in a book called The Puritan Conversion Narrative by Patricia Caldwell. I don't know, it's an old book now, but it is an unbelievably beautiful book on the subject. And she talked about how the difference between British, English conversion narratives and American conversion narratives. And what she said was so striking. She said that when you read a British conversion narrative, right, it's very nice. You know, people, they go, they have their experience with Christ, and then it's good. You read an American one, and you think they're going to hell. Right? You think they're supposed to be making a confession of faith, and they get up and say things like, well, I have had no experience of the Spirit. I'm probably damned, and I hope, you know, there's my conversion. And there's like this stuttering and brokenness. And she talks about it as this kind of what happens in the cross, you know, the sort of Atlantic crossing. And the brutality, right, the kind of sudden realization of you are in a new reality and it is not what you expected and it is brutal and harsh. And that brutality and harshness came into the language. And and is there. And I think Dickinson, I mean, I think Dickinson is enormously indebted to the 17th century, right? Certainly to the English 17th century, right? I mean, Herbert, she has copied out lines from Herbert, which she relineates in her broken way, right? But she uses that, but I think it's that, you know, it's a kind of mystical vision, but it's also one that is stark. And I mean, I always think of Dickinson as the person left behind by the, you know, the sort of massive conversions of the 19th century, left behind by the sentimentalism of that time. And frankly, when she moves into that sentimental realm, which she does occasionally, that's where I get really uncomfortable, right? That's where I think she gets weak as a writer. And when she stays away from it, when she's sort of true to that 17th century sense of things, she's beautiful. I recently found, it's a very funny story, but I was looking for a font. I was trying to find a font that I wanted to use for these transcriptions. And you know how it is, you look at all these fonts. And I found this font called Plantagenet Cherokee. Do you like that one? Now I have to use Plantagenet Cherokee for everything. Because to me, it's this, I love the name, right? And this idea of the Plantagenet, right? This sort of royal, sovereign sense. And then this Cherokee, this obviously sort of wild wilderness sense, kind of shoved together in this font. And to me, that's also Dickinson, right? At the height, this incredible kind of sovereign sense of language, of sovereign use of it. But also never forgetting that she's very close to a kind of wildness and a margin and an edge. And that's where I want to meet her. I think it's hard to do that. You know, I think, and I also think that whatever I were to write about her, it would also be obviously infused by the moment in which I live. Right? And postmodernism helps me out. Right? But it's not the 17th century. Right? And so that, and being aware, right, of the way, you know, a kind of postmodern discourse that finds fragments. And I do think that there's a reason why I work on these documents now, right? And it's not just mine, right? It has to do with an interest that my century has in these kinds of materials, right? That's pushing me always, right? That shows a kind of kinship with what Dickinson was thinking about, but it's also a big distance. And I guess, I mean, when I think about writing about Dickinson, I'm very, very aware of the distance between myself and her. I don't feel, and it's funny, it's a question I get asked a lot because I work with manuscripts. People always say to me, oh, you know, you're some sort of manuscript fetishist, and you go in there and you think, you know, you're sort of channeling Emily Dickinson. No. I mean, it's really the reverse. I mean, and it's really in a very kind of strange way, the reverse. When I look at those pieces of paper, which frankly look a whole lot brighter on the screen than they ever look, you know, in the archive where they're dark and smudged and hard to see, photography does wonders of sort of shooting light through things that are not really light at all. That I'm aware that I don't know who that person was who wrote those things on that paper, and I'm never getting any closer to her. And what I can do is look at them and look at them and look at them and try to contextualize as much as I can, try to also be clear and honest about the distance between that piece of paper and me, and be clear and honest about what is it that brings me to that piece of paper, which is not necessarily just a personal interest or a professional one, but a century's interest that I'm only partly aware of, you know, and in control of. Interesting one, and it's always one that I'm never sure how to answer, because on the one hand, they did save everything, right? I mean, Dickinson wrote on everything, and that would have been, you know, certainly typical of her day. But on the other hand, I have seen Dickinson write rough drafts on gilt-edged stationery. Right? Literally, gilt-edged stationery. And she just jots something down as if this piece of paper were nothing. You know, the Dickinsons were wealthy. Dickinson could afford paper. And there was a lot of it. So I think, you know, it's a very hard question, because the question of how are, you know, what's the meaning of these, I mean, is she just using something as a piece of scrap? What is its use? The only thing that I come back to when I think about that is that she saved them. So whatever the meaning of the paper is for her, however she saw it, whatever, when she then used it, that became something that she didn't throw away. And to me, that's kind of extraordinary, right? For somebody who was constantly rereading her work, and I love, you know, I actually was so amazed when I was looking at some of those poems that are in the fascicles, and then I found her returning to them 10, 15 years later and rethinking them. It was clear that she was somebody who periodically went back into her stockpile of materials and was rereading and rethinking it. So when, assuming that she was doing that, that she also continued to keep these pieces of paper, suggests to me that she was imagining them as more than scraps. But I don't, you know, it's one of those things. I don't know. The very fascinating thing to me about the envelopes, and I don't have an explanation for it. I really don't understand it. And I was taken aback by the phenomenon, and if any of you have any ideas, please tell me. I really need to know. But I was really haunted by those ones where she would write in beautiful hand, like a lot of them are to Mrs. Holland. There's quite a number to Mrs. Holland, where she just writes Mrs. Holland's name in a lovely fair copy hand, as if she's going to address that envelope and send it. And then she uses the envelope for to jot down a poem. And I could not find any, what I would could consider reliable connection between Mrs. Holland and the poem. I couldn't do it. I would have been stretching to such an extent, I wouldn't know what to do with it. But I can't really understand why she did that. You know, or was it simply a case, in this case, of had she addressed that envelope, thought she was going to use it, right, then didn't use it, and then used it for the poem. Right? It's certainly clear that the address was written first. Or I should say almost clear that the address was written first, and then the poem was. But it's one of those things that I don't know. And even with things like handwriting, with even figuring out what was written first, whether it was the poem or the address, I'm going on what could be a very erroneous logic. Right, by imagining that you would begin with a fair copy text, and then if you decided you weren't going to use that, then you would turn it into a rough copy text. But I might be wrong about that. And even with those, even dating things with the handwriting, the rough copy script just didn't change in the same way that the fair copy script did. So it's much harder to tell the period to which a text belongs when it's written in the rough copy. The fair copy, you know, it evolves over time, and you can at least say, I'm not so optimistic as Ralph Franklin in that you can actually date things by years and months and years. I don't think that's possible. But I do think you can get general ideas about early, middle, late. I do. One of the beautiful, I wish I brought a copy of it, but one of the beautiful things that Jen and I did was to collate letters. And we collated all of the letters, finding many, many, numerous examples, probably 50 examples of each letter, to look at it over time and see how letters changed. But it's almost impossible to do that with the rough copy drafts. But these are questions that are fascinating but unanswerable.